Ms. Union, Ms. Willihan.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court? This appeal is about...
Could you speak a little louder or maybe draw the microphone nearer to your mouth?
Can you hear me now?
That's better.
A little better, but I...
You can raise the podium, too.
This appeal is about the amount and the allocation of a common fund contingency fee that were incorrectly determined because the Court used the wrong methodology. And then we raised a third issue about some post-judgment conduct that came after the fee was already earned during fee proceedings.
Could you describe in the proverbial 25 words or less what methodology you are saying the Court should have followed?
The Court should have done what Kirchhoff v. Flynn recommends, which is to use the method lodestar or percentage that is most commonly used in the marketplace and then assess the risk to counsel ex ante at the time they came into the case, which may be different for different bands of counsel, and the productivity. That isn't what the Court did.
Well, I mean, you say that isn't what the Court did, but of course we have this very lengthy report from the Court-appointed expert, Mr. Feldman, and I think Mr. Feldman thinks he's doing that. And so what I'm really my biggest concern about this case is whether this is, in fact, a problem of fundamental methodology, which might take us in the direction of a legal issue, or whether you really, at the end of the day, are saying that the Court abused its discretion, both in coming up with the global reasonable fee for the common fund and also the allocation among counsel.
Let me answer first with respect to Mr. Feldman. However well-intentioned he might have been, there is nothing in the evidence that shows that he's competent to assess a contingency fee, a plaintiff's counsel's contingency fee. If you look at his website, he's never practiced in an MDL. It appears that he has never represented anyone under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and he's never represented a plaintiff class on a contingency basis in a consumer case.
Why does that make him – I mean, the district judge finds that he's done a very good job. The district judge praises him for the careful work and actually adopts his opinion. Is that also criticism you have of Judge Gettleman?
No, Your Honor. And I didn't raise the issue that the master was incompetent. I was simply answering your question. The reason his methodology is mistaken is because, first of all, in connection with the fee determination, he assesses post-judgment conduct that's not part of a fee determination. The fee was already earned when the post-judgment conduct occurred. And then as part of the risk analysis, he assesses cases that are not analogous to our case. He assesses securities cases in which there were large actual damages and a history, a significant history, of class certification. We were under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, in which, at the outset of the case, there had never been a successful national class certification. I certified the first class under the FCRA, and it was a settlement class. The litigation class I certified was reversed in Washington, D.C.S.C.
Let me see whether I understand your argument. So correct me if I'm wrong, because I just find this difficult to wade through the master's report. Now, so the other lawyers, the lawyers who got the bulk of the fees, they you say, if I'm correct, they were willing to settle for $40 million, $20 million in cash, $20 million in, you know, other consideration. And you say the ultimate settlement was $104 million.
$109, Your Honor.
$109 million. Okay. So in other words, you and the other later entering lawyers you're suggesting you and the others were responsible for that $69 million increase, and you got $2,700,000?
Yes, Your Honor. It's about 3%.
So what would you estimate your share of the credit for that extra $69 million was? Would you say it was half, it was two-thirds, it was one-third, or?
What the court gave me was about 3.9%, and I think that's incorrect. That doesn't follow
but
this court's...
that doesn't answer the question.
I'm sorry, maybe I didn't understand your question. Are you asking what I think my contribution was?
To that $69 million, how much should be credited to you?
Well, I think that if the MDL, the California Council, who call themselves the MDL Council, they got 19.9%.
You, what amount of that $69 million do you think you are responsible for?
The same, all of it.
All of the $69
million? 69. And the reason is... the master miscalculated that the first counsel there were responsible for the extra portion that we got.
Supposing you're correct about the $69 million, what would you think the reasonable fee for you would be? As what percentage of the $69
million? Well, I would look to the marketplace, and I would see what the market assigns.
You know, you must have a view. What do you think?
Well, sure. The master gave 19.9% to the California Council. It would be the same to me.
So you would want 20% of the, which is $17.8 million.
If that's what the master assessed,
and
using his reasoning.
No, I'm just interested. I just want to see what's at
using
stake.
His reasoning.
So you think a reasonable fee would be almost $18 million, and the judge gave you less than $3 million. So is that the approximate framework for us to think about this case?
That isn't what I've asked you for, but yes. If you want to use the master's reasoning, why would it be different for the first part from the second part when the first part that they obtained shows the value that they had accrued up until the point that twice they could never get more than that? That's the way plaintiffs, when there's a dispute among plaintiffs' counsel, apportion fees. People get paid on the amount they got.
So these, what you call the MDL lawyers, did they make no contribution? So we're just talking about the increment, the $69 million on top of the original settlement they were wanting to make. Did they do nothing in that later phase of the case to try to, you know, get the additional damages?
They opposed me trying to get the additional damages. They opposed it. Their rule set. They filed a Rule 72A motion opposing the master's, the magistrate's rejection of their second $40 million settlement. They opposed.
Just to throw in another factor, though, this was during a time period when Judge Gettleman was refusing to certify a national class on the marketing claims. And so the value of the case to TransUnion was based on that underlying legal assumption. Later on, Judge Gettleman signals maybe he is inclined to certify it, and he makes the statement to TransUnion, you've got to put a lot more money on the table.
If I could address that, Your Honor. First of all, I made that argument to Judge
Gettleman. Well, I understand that, but you're making arguments to us today. I'm a little... how to put this, I guess I tend to think of judges as a little bit more than just cat's paws for lawyers' arguments. I mean, the thought that, okay, you made that argument, but I assume Judge Gettleman was off there thinking for himself as well, and other people were making arguments, and the Supreme Court was deciding cases, and this court was deciding cases, and there were a lot of things going on.
Actually, Judge Gettleman was not involved. The magistrate was doing the negotiating among the settlement of the settlement until the end. But here's the important part. This court decided Murray v. GMAC in January of 2006 before the other counsel ever accepted their first settlement offer, let alone the second one. So the settlement landscape had changed long before, and I argued that it changed. If you look at my opposition to the first settlement and the second settlement, I argued that, and I point that out in the brief. And when Judge Gettleman said it changed, he was agreeing with my arguments.
I'm losing the thread. Now, suppose that $40 million proposed settlement is perfectly fine, you know, perfectly reasonable, but nevertheless, you and others oppose it because you think you can do better, which is fine. And then you end up with the extra $69 million, which is excellent. But my question was a narrow one. After that settlement is rejected, the $40 million, and we move up to the $109 million, did these MDL lawyers make no contribution to those in those additional proceedings? Should they get zero? Because that's what you're suggesting.
I negotiated the final settlement, Your Honor. My time records show that, and I can. It's not pointed out as clearly as it should have been in the brief, so I'd like to give you the record pages of that. My time records show that I negotiated the final settlement.
How can your time records by themselves show that? I mean, they certainly would show that you were having meetings and that you were negotiating. I don't think anyone doubts that. But we have a brief from Texas counsel who take the position, at least, that they were also contributing to that last phase that Judge Posner is describing. And we also have the brief from the MDL plaintiffs who essentially, as I understand it, argue you wouldn't even have been in that last phase had they not kept the case alive during all those years, filed in time to toll the statute of limitations, et cetera.
At page 9490 of the record, you'll find a memo transmitted by the Texas Council that's called the Wheelahan Memo, the Wheelahan Plan Memo for Settlement.
Yeah, but they have an interpretation of that as to whether it's going to be a B1A class or a B3 class or whatever. I mean, apparently there's a lot of dispute. There's dispute about everything in this case,
sure,
which makes it very hard to read through anything.
I've lost your initial question. The court in court testimony, and I put this in the brief. It's at page 29 of the opening brief. The district court says we have chosen Magistrate Mason and I have chosen the Wheelahan plan for settlement over the alternative plan suggested by the MDL Council.
No, that's fine, but again, my question is simply: did the other lawyers they did put in some time during this period, didn't they?
I think they've been paid for the time they put in, Your Honor, and that's what I argue in my question.
But I thought you wanted to get all of the fees. Maybe I'm wrong, so correct me if I'm wrong. But I thought your view was that so far as the extra $69 million, that creation of that $69 million in value, you are the only lawyer who should be compensated for that. Because the others... Didn't you say that?
I'm sorry. I didn't argue that the Texas Council should not be compensated for it because I didn't think I needed to.
But I thought what you said was that a reasonable fee for this for creating $69 million in value would be 20%. And I thought you said you should get all of that 20%. That implies that these other lawyers, after the $40 million settlement was rejected, either didn't do any work at all or their work was... made no contribution.
They've been paid for the work they did, Your Honor. They've been paid 19.9 million, not percent.
Wait a second.
Sorry.
They were paid for work they did in the second phase?
They were paid enough to compensate the work they did. In the special master's report, and I think it's page 51 or 52 of the order, he says that the additional value came from three things, one of them being the Louisiana target certification of the Louisiana target marketing class. Then he says we're entitled to nothing for the first $40 million. How can he say on one page that our class certification contributed to that first $40 million, and then in the next page he says we're not entitled to anything for it? What I've made to you is
need to do is kind of calm down and clarify, you know,
okay.
Judge Posner is suggesting we have the first $40 million. That's part of the special master's report, too. He actually separates out the first $40 million that other counsel were able to get on the table, if you will, and the additional 69. And if, let's suppose everybody quit the day after the rejection of the $40 million settlement, except you, and you were the only one going on. That would be an easy case. Then whatever else the settlement was must have been because of your efforts. But I thought we were trying to get at whether the other counsel were doing anything in that second phase, and their records seem to indicate they think they were. You don't think so, apparently.
It's not that they weren't doing anything. It's that they were overcompensated for the first 40 because part of what went into making the first 40...
It would be nice if we could forget about the first 40, at least for a moment. Just
okay.
Focus on the next 69.
Okay.
Well, I guess what you're saying is they shouldn't get anything for the next 69 because they got more than they should have for the first 40. Is that your argument?
That's part of it, Your Honor, yes, because the master didn't count the Louisiana class certification of target marketing claims in the first 40. The district court said recognized the target marketing claims were where the real money was. I see that my light is on.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. So the district court recognized that that certification was what created part of the first value, and the master recognizes it too, then says we're not entitled to anything for the first 40, and then cuts us on the rest as well. To answer your question directly, the MDL Council didn't help negotiate the second settlement, but they did contribute in paperwork. They contributed in the end to the administrative things that go into settling a class action.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Willihan. Mr. Isaacson?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Eric Allen Isaacson with the MDL Plaintiffs' Council. The standard review in a case like this is abuse of discretion.
You make a big contribution to the second $69 million, didn't she?
The special master said she made a contribution and gave her $2.7 million, Your Honor.
$2.7 million for $69 million is really, that's 4%. That would be very low. So that would suggest, you know, that her if you thought 20% was some reasonable fee, then if you give her $2.7 million, the implication is that she contributed only only $13.5 million in value to the 69. Is that plausible?
Well, Your Honor, I think that you've got a case where the value of the case is primarily attributable to the work that had been put in for 8 years by MDL counsel working the case.
And the work leading up, and forget whatever contribution she may have made to the first settlement, but that first $40 million, set that aside. Where the real question is, or the most important question is, what did she contribute to that next $69 million? Now, as I say, if she's awarded $2.7 million, $2.7 million is 20% of $13.5 million. So the implication, I mean, obviously it's very rough and so on, but the one way to interpret the magistrate's endless opinion is that he thought really, she contributed of the $69 million. She really only added. She only could take credit for $13.5 million.
Well, Your Honor, I think that to say that she added all of that value is incorrect.
She even says that there that you know the other lawyer at least did some administrative work. That's fine. No, the question is, did she? Is it plausible that of that $69 million that was added, her share was a modest, you know, $13.5 million, which would be about 20%?
But I guess can I complicate this a little further, because I think we have two things in play here. One of them is the cap on overall fees for everybody that the magistrate judge comes up with. And that number seems to have started out as maybe potentially up in the $18 million range, and then the district judge thought it was going to be down in the $10 million range, and then the special master comes up with approximately $13 million. So step one, against which all of these numbers have to be measured, is the cap. And, of course, one could criticize that methodology. Maybe you should say everybody should be stuck with the agreed 18 and some, maybe, or whatever. Then step two is, if that's the cap, how do we allocate between the first 40 and the second 69?
Well, Your Honor, I think that you have to leave that to the discretion of the trier of fact and the district court. I mean, it's a discretionary determination.
But there you may can be abuse a number. Discretion. I mean, what if she was really responsible? I'm looking at the chart on page 34 of the special master's opinion, which is also called page 48 of 91 of the district court's opinion, where he recommends a very big chunk of this overall set of fees for your group, the MDL people, 63.33. He calls it 22% for Ms. Wheelahan and 14.67 for the Texas Council.
What increased the value of the case, Your Honor, was Judge Gettleman's willingness to reconsider the denial of a statutory damages case under the FCRA.
Ms. Wheelahan says that's because of her arguments.
And the district court says that it's not. The district court is in the position to evaluate how important a role she played in that. It's not like this court's opinion was a secret. It's not like you can expect that district judges in the Seventh Circuit don't pay attention to this court's opinions. Magistrate Judge Mason thought that the opinion was very important, and it was Magistrate Judge Mason's position on that, quite frankly, that probably was what persuaded Judge Gettleman.
So now, no one should get anything.
Pardon me?
No one should get anything.
No, I'm not saying that no one should get anything. I'm saying it's a decision that's committed.
You should get the fee, right?
It's a decision that's committed to the sound discretion of the district court.
You lost me completely. Now, what you're saying is someone discovers a case. The judge discovers a case. That changes the whole. Well, there shouldn't be any fee for that.
Now, what I'm trying to say, Your Honor, well, the fee is based on the fact that we've got a case that's ready to go to trial. That is already, you know, that litigators have been litigating for 10 years.
If the lawyers get a windfall, a court suddenly decides a case, and as a result they have a winner, that's no reason to give them a big fee.
Well, if the Supreme Court decides that in a given area of law that there are going to be treble damages, and it triples the damages that are available in a case that plaintiffs' counsel have been litigating for 10 years, you don't say that somebody who intervenes with the new Supreme Court opinion gets the credit for that increase.
But neither should the original lawyers.
Yeah. And
why
I
should they get credit for something they have nothing to do with?
Well,
and
you
I
can
thought
say,
that's why the special master and then the district court judge looked at the overall recovery, didn't give amounts to the council as a whole. That look more like regular contingent fee contracts, that they were nowhere near the 33% level or the 20. It was a much lower overall percentage, and I think it's because of this effort, successful or otherwise, we can decide, of the master to take this ex-ante approach. You know, how much risk was there? How did the risk shift over time? The risk went down when these opinions came out, and that's why you wind up with a number that's significantly lower than 20% of the common fund or 30% or other numbers you might expect to see.
Well, when you get retained in a case, you know, ex ante, you always know that the law is going to develop. If it's going to be litigated over many years,
sure,
that the law could get better, the law could get worse. That's one of the things that goes into the risk calculation. All cases that all attorneys litigate are litigated under rulings of law by this court and the Supreme Court.
We know that. And I'm just saying that part of this fact of who's responsible for the ultimate success of the settlement, is it the judge, is it the lawyers, is it the keeping of the case alive? A lot of people can take credit for it, but I think the district judge's overall award reflects his assessment of that.
That's correct.
It's a little lower.
That's correct, Your Honor. The district judge's award reflects his assessment of that. There may be aspects of the award that are disappointing to my firm, but that doesn't mean that we can take an appeal.
Let's look at this 12.7 million that was awarded that we're.
Yes, Your Honor. 12.9 million.
And your lawyer, your guys were given what percentage of that? 50%?
We were given about 7.8 million.
How many?
7.8 million.
You were given 70. You were given 60%. And 60. Okay.
Thereabouts.
What had you done to earn that 60%?
We started working on the case back in 1998.
No, that's not what we're talking about. This 12.7 million is for the later phase of the representation.
Well, didn't the magistrate judge separate it? He said you're responsible for all of the first 40 and you're responsible for
50%.
50% of the latter half.
Yeah, basically.
So why did he think you were due 50% for the part that Ms. Wheelahan thinks she should have all of?
Because there would have been no case at all for Ms. Wheelahan to come into had it not been for all of that work.
Yeah, but that's
all
true.
Of those years.
No, that's not. That's like saying if Columbus hadn't discovered America, there would have been no award, right?
No, I don't think so.
I think it is. Because you guys were giving up. You were giving up with the $40 million. Then you have the decision. Now you're back in the game. But the question is, okay, what did you do after that? Did you sit back? What you're saying is that if you've done nothing in that second phase, you would have been entitled to 50%.
Suppose
you had done nothing in the second phase. Would you have been entitled to any part of the $12.7 million?
I would think so. In the discretion of the trial court to decide that, Your Honor.
Sam?
I'm not saying we did not. Pardon me?
50%?
Yeah, probably.
If you had done nothing, but I thought you were saying you did do something.
We did
a lot. And got the.
But you think that's irrelevant? It's irrelevant, right?
We were involved.
If you had done, you could have said to the judge, "Well, we have this great decision, and you know, going to be more damages, and if it weren't for us, it'd be nothing. So we're not going to do anything more, but we're expecting to get at least half of the fee, probably all of it."
And we did not say those things. We filed a brief.
You're saying it to us.
No,
you're saying if you had done zero, you would have been entitled still to 50%.
I'm not sure I understand why the hypothetical is relevant, because it's contradicted by the facts. We did a lot.
Hypotheticals are always different from the case. Don't you understand what a hypothetical question
is?
Yes,
Your Honor.
My hypothetical question to you was, if you had done absolutely nothing, would you still have been entitled to 50%? You said yes.
I think it would be within the discretion of the trial court to say yes, because there would have been no case at all but for our work.
What kind of exercise of discretion is that?
And
I mean, that sounds like what? If he's feeling good, he gives you the 50%. What would guide his exercise of discretion in that case?
The fact that we were in the position to take the case to trial.
50%, right.
The fact that we were in the case to take the case to trial, that we were going to take the case to trial, and that's why TransUnion was willing to enter any settlement at all. Now, we were hindered by the fact that this court would not take our 23F appeal.
In the second phase, for which you got the 50% or whatever it is, how much time did you put in relative to Ms. Wheelahan?
I'm not certain of the precise hours, and I'm not certain of the reliability.
Precise.
Why don't you just describe what you did in that second half, if you will? And, I guess you're also making an argument that the reason TransUnion was still willing to come to the table to anybody is that you did have a credible threat of going to trial. And, of course, by the time you had a class of 190 million people, they were likely to listen.
Yes. Well, one of the things that the Wheelahan plan that we've heard about was going to do was to give all of the cash to charity. None of it would have gone to the class. We strongly opposed that. We were there to make sure that the class got relief, which I think is consistent with this court's precedent.
Wait a second. What could the class? I don't understand. The class couldn't get anything.
The $75 million cash settlement?
Yeah, okay. Divide that by 190 million. That's like, what, 30 cents a
We've had hundreds of thousands of claims made, Your Honor. And we've had
gets paid out on each claim?
Not a whole heck of a lot, because TransUnion can't pay a whole heck of a lot.
Okay. Let's be concrete. How much? You say not a heck of a lot.
It's going to be a fraction.
What is it? A number? A dollar number?
I don't have a dollar number for you, Your Honor.
Give me a rough estimate.
It will be a percentage of the $100.
A rough estimate.
I can't give you a rough estimate as I stand here.
What if it's a dollar?
I would be happy to put it in a letter to the court.
What if it's a dollar?
What if it's a dollar? This court's opinion in Murray versus GMAC and the precedents that it cites says that even if it's going to be a small amount, it ought to be going to the class.
That's ridiculous. The postage is more than the dollar. The processing of the claim. That's absurd. If you have a class action where you're going, where the class member is going to be entitled to a dollar, that's ridiculous. Of course you do something else with the money. It'd be preposterous.
My reading of Murray versus GMC is that would be inappropriate.
Look, are you saying that if hundreds of thousands of people are each entitled to $1, that a proper remedy in a class action case is to verify the claim of each one and then send them a check for a dollar?
We also had.
Answer me. Is that sensible? Or is that preposterous?
Thank you, Your Honor. The fact is that in this.
Is that sensible or is it preposterous?
I think that reasonable minds might differ on that, Your Honor.
I don't think so.
Now, this case
I can't think of anything. Because what you're doing, of course, you're just throwing money down the drain. All the money spent on the postage. All the time of people opening there and seeing their little check for a dollar and going down to the bank to deposit their check.
People, but that was not your settlement, as I recall.
No, that's not the settlement. The settlement also provided for in-kind relief. The 34
Which
and a half,
is what Ms. Wheelahan thought the whole thing should be. Right?
$34.6 million in in-kind relief reflects actual claims that were, in fact, made. And most of the people who requested the in-kind relief also requested the cash award. So there'll be some cash on top of the $34.6 million that was actually given to people who made claims for in-kind relief worth $50, $60, $70 apiece. Now, when it comes right down to it, we played a role in negotiating the outlines of that settlement, the framework of that settlement, and we were absolutely critical to there being any settlement of any kind
at all. That's the separate point.
Well,
that's going back to your causality argument. That's not the question that Judge Wood asked you, which is what actually you did in the latter phase of the case to contribute to the resolution.
What we did in the latter phase of the case is that we were involved in all of that. So was Texas Counsel.
So, just to cut through this, it seems to me your argument has to be that the mechanics of working out settlements in mega class actions like this are themselves often very complicated and take a lot of work to make sure that you haven't flushed it all away, you know, with wasteful practices like the one Judge Posner was talking about. And that I suppose if I'm understanding you, your argument is that you guys were the ones supporting those mechanics.
We were supporting those mechanics. We were involved in the negotiation.
So how much time did you spend relative to the other lawyers?
I would be happy to submit a supplemental brief on that if you'd like, Your Honor.
Did the master or the magistrate, whatever, the district judge discuss the relative time?
In terms of relative time for that period of the case, I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Well, but I don't understand. Look, putting aside your causality argument and following up on what Judge Wood was saying, we're now looking at what was the actual work done in this latter phase on the mechanics of the settlement, which I agree are very important and difficult given the size of the class. So that's fine. But you'd think that the basic guideline for allocating fees for that latter phase would be how much time each firm had put in. And then, of course, you make adjustments for quality if you want. But I don't know how you could do your 50%, 10%, what have you, without looking at the time.
Well, Ms. Wheelahan billed more than 24 hours a day, Your Honor. If we want to look at the time.
Then that's not responsive to my question. How could the special master make a recommendation without having said something about the relative time of the different lawyers in the second phase?
The special master reviewed all of the time records.
Did he say anything in his opinion?
Not differentiating the two periods, no.
Well, okay, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Ms. Wheelahan, your time has expired. We'll give you a minute if you have anything further. Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel.